I've done so many courses. I have been in homes with kids who are in their beds, and we're doing colonic clean outs, and we're doing wheelchair transfers, and I've seen it, I know it, but I did not know it until it's me.
Hello, you're listening to The Rare Life. I'm your host, Madeline Cheney. Today, I have a beautiful story episode with Serena Morrison, mom to her one-year-old son, Rudy, with a rare degenerative disease. Serena is the co-founder of an organization called PlaySpark, and I'm actually going to quote her directly about this because she said it really well. She said, "PlaySpark started as a place to lift up families with disabled children and educate therapists on neurodiversity-affirming practices. It was almost like we created this company in preparation for Rudy without even knowing it." Isn't that just a really cool perspective to be coming from? I'm so excited for you to hear our conversation and her story. One thing I find fascinating with this episode is that Serena shares various thoughts about disability and her son's diagnosis that almost seem like contradictions. And I think this just goes to show how complex our relationship with our children's diagnoses can be. Like, so complicated. That's how I feel too. And I think they're ever shifting and evolving, and a million things impact that. Our life experiences leading up to having our child, the amount of supports we have or don't have, the ways our children's diagnosis manifests and impacts our child and other members of our family, our mental health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I say all of that just to set the stage for you to leave lots of room for grace and self-compassion if you hear things said that you wish you could echo but can't necessarily do. We all experience things in our own way, and it is normal and natural. And at the same time, I know that there will be aspects that you relate with so hard. So buckle up and get ready for a super thought-provoking episode. Serena, her husband Sawyer, and their one-year-old Rudy live in Asheville, North Carolina. She is a pediatric speech-language pathologist and also runs PlaySpark, which is now a neurodiverse-affirming apparel business. Serena is a lover of her super awesome vacuum and of dancing. All right, let's dive in. Hi, Serena. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's so great to be here.
I'm like legitimately, I'm always excited to talk to people, but I feel, you know, extra level of excitement because I've followed you for a while and I'm like, she's just a really cool person. So I'm excited to chat and like hear your perspectives and your story because I think it's fascinating.
It is a pretty crazy story. It is a very fun story. If you don't know about it and you're listening for the first time, I think you will find this story interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I only know like bits and pieces. So like that makes me even more excited to get into it. So like without further ado, we start story episodes with like, tell me about when you first found out that something was going on medically or whatever. Mm-hmm. But your story does start before that, right? Like as far as like your background professionally.
Yeah.
Take us where we need to start. Where do we need to start with this story?
I think we would start with, I'm a speech-language pathologist, and my best friend, Kylie, is an occupational therapist. And in 2020, we started a business called PlaySpark that was centered around trying to help high support needs kids getting teletherapy services and how to engage with families. But that snowballed into Kylie and I having this vision of how to better support families and therapists for optimizing care and making sure that we have a neurodiversity affirming lens in our care. So Kylie and I used to work in home health, and we worked co-treating together with lots of different various, I mean, we worked from birth to all the way to 15, and we're in Madison County, which is rural North Carolina, lots of lower income homes. We would be driving in the back roads together, bringing cans of gasoline, filling each other's cars and getting into rural homes with the kids that really needed services. And what we found was that these families often had very stigmatized views of their children. And also the therapists that were working with them tended to lean towards this deficit mindset instead of strength-based. So anyway, Kylie and I had this big vision for PlaySpark and how to better support families and therapists. And so we ended up making apparel and doing webinars and coaching therapists and doing the research, reading every book there was neurotribes, demystifying disability, creating this whole atmosphere of strength-based celebrating differences. And then Kylie had a baby, and then I got pregnant, and it was with Rudy. And my pregnancy was perfect. Every visit was, this baby is so healthy, this baby is so perfect. There's nothing going on. There's nothing happening whatsoever. And then that changed after he was born, of course.
Wow. Yeah. So like really, you were like setting the stage for yourself and for Rudy, right? Like where you were like, I'm advocating for this community that I'm not necessarily a part of. And then all of a sudden, like, boom, you're in it.
Like I am very much a part of it now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. Like, all of a sudden, like, I am that person. Mm-hmm. And Rudy, right? And like to be equipped too with like your understanding of disability, like in a way that like a lot of us as parents, like if we didn't have experience with disability, which I think like most of us, right? Like we don't necessarily have like a sibling or a parent or, you know, ourselves being disabled, like that's not as common. And so mm-hmm. I think like being able to go into it with like already having like researched it and like debunked some of these myths about disability and like see it for more of what it is. I'm like, man, that's awesome. Like, I wish I would have had that. So that's amazing.
That's the thing is my whole pregnancy, I kind of had this spiel that I would say, like, if this kid is disabled, like I'm ready. I have my books stacked. You know about disability. I've been in disabled homes. Like I know about the families. I know about the medical trauma. So I thought, but the truth is like no amount of research could ever have given me the perspective of being a parent in this situation and how heavy it is. And although I thought I was perspective taking every day, you know, I really felt like I was in it with my families. I do not feel that I had any inkling of how intense the experience was for them and how valuable my role as a therapist was for them. Hmm. I mean, I thought we were valuable, but my kid's therapy is so valuable to me now. And the people that work hands-on with him are so valuable to me. And I don't think I fully understood like how much we mattered. We mattered more than I thought.
That makes total sense. Like in hindsight, you were like, oh my gosh, like I knew I was helping, but I had no idea. First of all, like the need that was there. I didn't realize the extent of it, right, and the weight of it and the breadth of it. And therefore how incredibly helpful the work I did was for them.
And how much of a difference we can make. Like the whole idea of PlaySpark was to try a better equipped therapist to better support families. And then understanding like, wow, when you're not the best therapist, like it really impacts families. Or when you're not the best medical director or whoever families are working with and they feel that like that negative stigma about your kid's disability, or I don't know. I've been through the gambit this year. I've seen a lot, and some things can gut you like a knife when they aren't properly addressed to families. It can be the most painful thing you've ever heard in your life, or you could be supported by a professional who knows how to talk to you in a strength-based method that kind of makes things a little bit easier to digest. I've heard some really hard things about Rudy, and I've been like, God, could you have said that in a different way? That might have been nice. Yeah.
Your passion for your work probably has like grown exponentially since that has happened.
Yes, it certainly has.
Wow. Okay, so without further ado, tell me about the day. Rudy, obviously, he had the healthy pregnancy, so there was none of that like preemption of like, okay, here's what's going to happen. When did you find out that he had any kind of like disability or medical complexity?
So at my birth was a little challenging, and this is kind of what was the red herring, is that my birth was not great, but it was not terrible. So Rudy didn't go to the NICU, but it was difficult to get him out. He was vacuumed multiple times. His Apgar scores were low. And then he shot back up and they sent him upstairs with us and we went home in 2 days. But in those 2 days, my therapist lens was very, very high. And I noticed immediately that Rudy looked different than a typical newborn in his supremely low tone. And he had what's called shoulder dystocia from not being able to evacuate the birth canal easily with the vacuum. His shoulder got stuck, so he was paralyzed on the right arm. But that arm is what made me have his pediatrician. The second day he was alive, I asked her for a referral to early intervention because I wanted to see a PT immediately because I was really concerned about that shoulder dystocia, but more so also concerned that his entire body wasn't moving as quickly and as strongly as you would see in a typical newborn. But nobody in the hospital was concerned about Rudy. You know, check, check, check. Everything was right, and we went home. But in 12 days, we had a PT from early intervention come to our home, and she noticed a global weakness that I saw too. And we just started going off of like, okay, let's see if we can get Rudy on his tummy time. Let's see if we can try and build his strength. And it's like when I think back to it, like the amount of hours I put him on his tummy, like waiting for him to try and perk up, and it just didn't happen. And weeks passed. He also had some weird clonus, so like shaking of the ankles, shaking of the hands, and just so low tone. I mean, even his grandparents were afraid to hold him because he was such a floppy baby and nobody felt like he had any structure. But still, though, I mean, he was moving, his shoulder started moving, the paralyzed arm started moving, and so we kind of felt optimistic, but his PT was pretty insistent that we went to see a neurologist just to be sure that there's nothing going on with, maybe there was low oxygen at birth and they didn't catch it. Maybe we have like some kind of spinal cord injury because of the clonus. We didn't know. And when he saw the neurologist, she wasn't concerned at first, but she wanted us to come back in a few weeks. And so we waited about 8 more weeks. And then when she saw him at that appointment, she agreed that there was something worth checking on the MRI. And that MRI, I remember feeling like, okay, there's something happening. But there's like a part of disability parenting where you're like, I'm in denial and everything's good. And also I know something is terribly wrong. So like, I'm like, it's going to come back completely normal. And on the other side, like it's going to come back and something bigger is afoot. And I know it. But the night before the MRI, it was definitely leaning less into the denial and more into like, what is this MRI going to tell us? And the MRI was very strange. And she called us 30 minutes after they got the results and was like, this is a very strange MRI. She thought it could have been something called periventricular leukomalacia, which kind of looks like CP and usually like falls into the CP umbrella. And honestly, that was the best news. Like CP, CP, I could do CP. Like CP is nothing. I'm like, I got this. Actually, my good friend Ashley, who runs the account Disability Reframe, she and I were talking and she was like, let's join the CP club. Like I was thinking this is CP. And honestly, right. CP for me was great news because I just was familiar with it and I like familiarity.
Yeah.
Even though CP is like the biggest umbrella and it means so many different things and there's tons of presentations of CP, I was familiar with cerebral palsy. So that was something that comforted me. But the neurologist said on that call that his MRI was so strange that there's a less than 0.1% chance that there's this thing that it could be.
It's famous so, last words.
So tiny, tiny chance. But let's just do a genetic test to rule it out because then we can close the chapter and move forward. She said on that call, Rudy would probably be the slowest runner of his friends. Like, that's what we were thinking.
Like, we got that. We can handle that.
The second she said the slowest runner, though, I was like, but she has this chapter she needs to close, right? We need to close this chapter. So we're going to do the genetic test. Rudy did this genetic test and Sawyer and I both did it too. And when we were all doing the saliva swabs that night at the kitchen table, I was like, I just feel like it's, what if it's the less than 0.1%? What if it is? Like, what if it is? What does that mean? And what is it? We didn't even know what it was that she was checking for. It's just potentially something.
She was probably like, it's so unlikely. I'm not even going to bother you by telling
you about it. Exactly. She's like, we don't need to worry about it. I just want it so that I understand that his MRI is just strange. And his MRI was just from a bad birth. That's what we were thinking because this periventricular leukomalacia was from losing oxygen at birth. It all makes sense, right? Because our birth was kind of weird, but it wasn't that weird. That's the part that she was like, your birth doesn't match up with this MRI. Like he would have been spending some time in NICU. Like it just, anyway. So we did the genetic testing and within a few weeks got that email that's like pathogenic LAMA2 muscular dystrophy, severe infant onset. And we were like, what the hell is that? Never heard of that. Start reading it, go down the rabbit hole and we're like, oh my God, this is not good. This is a bad diagnosis. Like I could not eat. I could not process. I barely could breathe when I found out what it was. It was just so much worse than I thought. So it was like, God, I wish it was CP because this is degenerative. This will kill him. Like this is like, there's disability and that sucks. Like in a lot of ways, like there's medical trauma. There's so much with it, but there were things that I could handle. But the degenerative piece of this diagnosis was like too much for me to bear at the time. I just couldn't believe it. But that is what he has. So from that point forward, it was like, okay, what are the treatments? None. What are the options for us? Like, oh, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing for you. There's nothing that exists in genetic treatments. There's no therapies. I started Zoom calling with Switzerland. I called every medical person who's ever worked with LAMA2, anything in the NIH research hub, like who can I talk to? Who are the researchers? Who's working on this? Who's the leading experts in the field? Who's going to help get me a genetic therapy? And the more I learned, like the more discouraged I felt, understanding how far away we are and how rapidly Rudy's growing and how his muscles are not going to be able to handle his growth. So yeah, I was like, those first bunch of weeks, it's just like me running on a hamster wheel, being like, I gotta find the solution. Where is it? Where is it? And there isn't.
I just want to touch on really quick too, like the whole, okay, how do we fix this? How do we get a cure? And like the huge issues there. Like I just was a part of like this pre-screening for a documentary about like the whole system of like how to get a cure. And the message of the documentary was not like, here's how you go get a cure. Because in the end they did, but it took way too long and way too much money. So like the person's child still passed away from it. Like there was nothing they could do at that point. And so the whole point of it was like, there is a huge issue with the way that we go about treating or like not treating rare disease, right? Like the system that's in place is just not, it doesn't work. And just, you know, going down that side path a little bit, like it's just so unethical and it's so unfair because they were talking about how like a lot of the technology is already there. It's the money. Like you need millions and millions of dollars
Oh,
to
it's
do it.
all
And
money.
it's all money. And so like the ways that it touches real people's lives, like you explaining this story and like all the other parents who are listening and can relate, like there is no worse news you could possibly receive. Like nothing worse could happen to you than finding out that your son will pass away. Like there's nothing worse. And like you said, CP, we got this. Like you were so prepared for that way more than I think most parents that would have a child with CP, right? That would be this big deal to them and be like, oh my gosh, what are we gonna do? But like you knew, you were ready. And so to be like, wait, but it's this other more hidden side of disability that we don't really talk about very much, like the side of it where like they will pass away from this. Like this is so horrendous and there's no silver lining. There's no treatment. There's nothing you can do.
No, that's what I meant by when I said, like, there's disability and then there's a disease that will kill him. And, like, I had the prep to understand how to modify my house, how to lift Rudy's self-esteem, how to incorporate him into every aspect of life, how to make the world as accessible to him as possible. But the fact that this is going to kill Rudy if there's no treatment is like, okay, now that I cannot prepare. None of my expertise and none of my comfortability with disability will help me get over that. That's painful beyond. I mean, I'm still in the first year, but I'm like, is there anything that's going to come? Like, are we going to get somewhere? Like, are we going to get millions of dollars raised for this? We're rare. Like, we're rare. Kimball's rare. Like, we're rare people. Like, they're not raising funds for us right now. We're just like this community of the lost people who have kids with diseases that will kill them. And what are we going to do? It's awful.
And I think that's like one of the aspects of rareness that is so horrendous that it's like not only do you feel like lonely and there are very few people who can like relate on that level of like, I know the diagnosis, I understand like all these aspects, but then also like the feeling of, well, if he had CP, like there'd be this huge community, tons of resources. I would have a clue of what it even means. Same with things like these different like cancers where they're able to like research that because it's so advocated for, it's so talked about. So it's like I got the wild card of like whatever that tiny percentage was, where she was like, there's like 0.01% chance that that's this other thing. And like we all got the wild card of that, like the lottery ticket, I guess, of like
I know.
this super rare thing is like no one's going to do anything about this because there's so few people that are affected by it. It's just so unfair.
I hate it. I just hate it. I really, really do. But then there's also the piece of like, okay, now we know we're rare. There's no cure. What do we do now? Like, now we have to keep going, and Rudy has to live a happy life, and I have to be his mom. And there's so many other major complications with being severely disabled that I have control over and that I can help him with. And those things, oddly enough, do give me comfort, like knowing that I can do some things to make Rudy's life as valuable and inclusive as possible for him, like that gives me comfort. So I like really tend to lean on that like I know that disabled life is not a tragedy. The part that's a tragedy is that Rudy's body will give out because this disease is going to deteriorate him. But his disability is not the tragedy. It's the disease. I don't know. Disability and disease for me, I'm mentally having to like break them apart so that I don't think of his disability as the tragedy, because it's not.
And I think like a lot of parents who don't have a background or a lot of exposure to disability, right? Like the parents you were working with as a professional, there is like a lot of sadness there too. And like grief of like, oh, I thought we'd be able to like, you know, play sports together and we can't, or like,
right,
she'll never see my face or hear my voice. We're like, those are not in and of themselves. They're not tragedies, right? Like that is not what's going to make them pass away. But I think there's space for feeling all the feelings about all of it.
Of course, everything's on the table.
Yeah. But to your point, like, the true tragedy, that there's no silver lining spin, there's no like, okay, but like, think of it this way, is that it will take their life. Like, there's no good in that. There's nothing good in that.
There's nothing good in that. And that it will hurt him. Like, he will experience tremendous pain when he can't breathe because his diaphragm does not inhale. He is going to experience some very painful things you want to shield your kid from forever. Like, I want him to be pain-free, but I'm so deeply involved now in the LAMA 2 community, the small community that we are. I feel like I'm talking to LAMA 2 moms every day, but they're all chapters ahead of me. They don't have a baby. They have their teenager who's in the hospital passing away right now. I mean, there's two kids in our community right now who we might lose them this week. We don't know. But you know, just since Rudy's been diagnosed, two community members passed away and they were both in their teens, and it was devastating. Like, I feel like you probably feel this way too. But I remember in your first episode, you were giving your backstory, that you said that Facebook community of like, it was a very small, close-knit group of people who were experiencing the same diagnosis. And that, I like fall on that group every single day. But seeing what happens to these kids since they're so far ahead of Rudy, I'm like watching my future, and it's not fun.
Yeah. How have you coped with that? Like that anticipatory grief for yourself, and I'm assuming grieving with those parents too, because you can picture it better than anyone, right? Like your son has the literal same diagnosis. Like, how have you coped with that grief?
I've like read Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now, and The Power of Now is all about being here now. As much as I know what's coming, it's not here in this exact moment. And for me, like getting extremely grounded in my current, very, very current place, like I'm sitting on the floor, I'm on a dog bed, I'm talking on the Rare Life podcast, that's my now. And if I continue to like practice my present mindfulness, I'm okay. But the second I start to step away from here, I'm honestly not able to function very well. In November, when one of our community members passed away, he was 14, and I was so upset. The second I saw his mom post, I was like, oh my God, I'm not gonna be able to handle this. But a few days passed, and then I was like, okay, Rudy is a baby. He's here. Like, he's not dying today. I have to stay with him now.
That makes total sense. Do you wish that you didn't know? Like, I'm just thinking, like, would it be easier if like you found out he has, like, oh, he's going to pass away next year. Like, almost like discovering, like, a cancer. Like, he's going to pass away in a year. And he's, like, at that point, he's a teenager. And, right, you know, maybe he had his whole life the same way he would have, like, you know, with the disabilities and everything involved. But you didn't know it would end his life early. Do you wish that, or are you glad for having time to process it?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I feel like I still don't know what his future holds. So I still don't know. But I do know that it helps me to focus more on my present-mindedness when I do know that things are kind of scary in my future. So I feel like the practice of mindfulness has probably been escalated or, you know, ramped up. And honestly, is a super valuable practice for me. I feel like I don't even have anxiety most of the time because I'm just trying to focus on being here, and it's helpful in a lot of different aspects of my life. But I don't know. It's a really good question. I mean, I don't want to know. I don't want to know it, but I also do want to know it because I want to understand completely and totally what is happening to his body. I'm a very scientific person. Like, I like to know, like, okay, well, what does this protein do? How does this protein affect muscles? So like, I don't know. I have to know because part of me is like knowledge seeking and finds comfort in knowledge. I don't know. It's kind of a rambling answer, but it's a really good question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not like we have a choice, right? So it's like, yeah, just a philosophical, hypothetical thing, but it's, yeah, just, I mean, the pain of looking at your baby, your literal baby, and being like, I will bury you someday. It's every parent's worst nightmare. And it's something that, like, no one else can truly understand. And I mean, it changes you as a person, right? Like, have you felt that?
Oh, I'm completely a different person, like a completely different person. And also, I still feel, and this might be like the naivete of the early years, but I still feel like there's a potential for a gene therapy to come that will help extend his life. There's potential for like better medical interventions, like Rudy could be trached or his spinal fusion could expand his lungs. I feel like I know all of these. I'm like, well, that could help extend his life. You know, his G-tube could help extend his life. But at the same time, like, I do know this disease will end him if there isn't treatment. So I don't know. I still have hope.
Yeah. That is so fascinating, the way like our brains are like, this is going to happen. I know it's going to happen. But at the same time, like, no, wait, but like, maybe it won't.
I hold on to the maybe it won't. And my husband, Rudy's dad, is deep into the hope. And I feel like his hope is, it like swallows the whole family, and in a good way. Like, he's a very hopeful and positive person. And he just truly believes that Rudy's story is going to be okay. And I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go with that. I like that. But also, I'm a very realistic person, so I'm trying to like be hopeful and also be super realistic so I can prepare.
Yeah. And at the same time, like, I think it kind of goes back to like what you were saying, like there's no way to truly prepare. There's no way that a person who is not going through disability parenting to understand what it's like to be a disability parent. Like, there's nothing you can do. There's no amount of research or perspective seeking.
I literally created a whole business around it. Like, I truly... Yeah. I've done so many courses. Like, I have been in homes with kids who are in their beds, and we're doing colonic cleanouts, and we're doing wheelchair transfers. And I've seen it. I know it, but I did not know it until it's me.
Yeah. And I think like that probably translates over too to like the loss world, right? So it's like, if that does happen with Rudy, you do lose him, then it's like, is there any amount of preparing that you can do to make it any easier? Like, I doubt it. Like, no. So I think that's where it kind of gets into like, well, yeah, hold on to that hope. Like, live in that space, because A, that really could happen, right? There's always that possibility. And yeah. B, like, that's something that I've thought too. Like, if I just prepare myself and I imagine it and stuff, then that would make it easier to lose someone. But I don't know that that would.
I don't think there's any way a parent could ever prepare to lose their kid.
Yeah.
Do you?
I mean, I think when the pain is so all-encompassing, like something like that that just fills up all the spaces inside yourself, like there's no amount of like siphoning off that. And like, I'll suffer through this now so I won't have to later. Like, yeah. I don't think there's any amount that you can do that, because it just fills up everything.
That's a really good description. I think you're absolutely right. And neither of us have experienced it yet, or hopefully we won't. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So bring me back to where you found out his diagnosis. You did all the research. You were hoping to find, okay, here's the way forward. Here's how we're going to beat this. Oh man, there's nothing there yet. And at that point, how old was Rudy? And like, bring us back from that point, like forward to where we are now.
Rudy was 6 months. I wanted to go to the best hospital in the country. So I researched that. And it was Cincinnati Children's for muscular dystrophy, and specifically for LAMA2. They had the most knowledge about it. So we scheduled 3 months out. We had to wait to get the appointment and meet with that team. And so now we're going to Cincinnati twice a year, which they are incredible. And that goes back to what I was describing earlier. When you have a team that can support you versus a team that cannot, and how much lighter you feel when you have the arms of a team that's truly equipped, it is everything. So after we finished our first Cincinnati appointment, we were like, wow, we're going to be okay, because we have these people who are incredible. But we had that 3 month interim. So Rudy went to NIH in December. So that was 2.5 months after he was diagnosed. And that was a terrible experience for us. It was awful. And it was because the team just wasn't there. So it was a series of mishaps that resulted in just people who didn't understand LAMA2 and were reading off a script and were describing things to me in detail that I was not ready to hear, even though I knew, but hearing it from someone who had a cold demeanor and just didn't see him. Also, they were taking photos of his body. It was like my first medical trauma. So now I have that in the boop. Okay, there's the first one. It's definitely in there now. And I can like still like feel it. It was just a really bad experience. But then just 2 weeks later, we ended up in Cincinnati. And those stark differences really reminded me just how important our professional work is, working with families. Yeah. It's a lot.
So we have listeners that are kind of in that like professional realm. Mm-hmm. Like they don't have kids that are disabled, but they listen as like a doctor, as a nurse, as a therapist. So for them listening right now, what would you say is like the biggest difference that made the Cincinnati team so much more of a positive experience for you?
I think we have to see the child first. So acknowledging that they are a person in the room that has strengths, that has curiosity, interest, presuming competence, and understanding that the child is capable of thinking and feeling. And when they are in the room with you, like, you need to acknowledge them and not just talk to the family. I think that for me as a professional, like, my biggest advice to other professionals is always act as though the child in the room is another person in the room. And you'd be surprised how often, I mean, maybe you wouldn't, but it's very disconcerting when a professional is only talking to you while the child is in the room and not acknowledging them at all, or pretending as though they can't hear or process what's going on. Rudy's a baby, but I could just tell that there were professionals that we had seen that were used to talking about children in front of them in a way that was not kind.
It's like dehumanizing, right? Like, it's such a lack of respect.
Extremely. There was just this moment where there were like four researchers who came in to take photos of Rudy's body, and the way that they were talking about him while he was there was like, I know he's a baby, so of course I'm not presuming that Rudy understood what was being said, but he does have the ability to understand that like these people are not engaging with him, they're engaging with his body. And like the separation of body and self was very strange.
Yeah,
this is a person that you're touching and taking photos of. Like, you have to be conscious of that.
Yeah, like, it's objectifying, right? It's like, this isn't just like a dummy that you're like in med school.
There's one part where one person lifted him and said like, oh, wow, his shoulders rise. It's just interesting. And then one of the other researchers was like, let me see. And then she did it. And then another person was like, can I? And then they all just, you know, were lifting him and like noticing how weak he was. And it was like, okay, I think we get it. Like,
yeah, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was awful. But I think acknowledging and presuming competence, and if you've ever worked with kids who have intellectual disabilities or been around families who have children with intellectual disabilities, I think that that's even more salient for those families, that they are tired of professionals acting like their child is not in the room. And that's really my expertise, is with intellectual disabilities more so than physical, as a speech pathologist. So I'm very defensive of those families. And like, I feel like those are my kids. So I'm like, they can hear and understand you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. When, like, even he was a baby, but like, you can interact with them the way you would a typical kid. That, yeah, right. If you had any other baby there, you'd be like, oh, how cute. Like, I remember Kimball's ENT. He thought, I mean, he acted this way, at least. I mean, this is what I believe about. He thought Kimball was the cutest kid. And he was like, oh, Kimball, my man, he's so cute. And I mean, he's a baby at this point, right? Like, in the hospital and stuff. And like, oh, hey, little guy. And then he'd do his like little check over. And I will tell you, I trusted him so much more, because I was like, this guy cares about Kimball, or at least he's a really good actor. But it felt real.
Exactly.
So I think, like, when you feel that caring and that they see them as a person, again, not just like they're in med school and here's like whatever experiment they're doing, like they see them as a person, then their advice and their ideas and their problem solving about how to help them is going to feel so much more like, I'll trust that.
Oh, yeah. It makes such a big difference. It really, really does. And then in addition, also, just making sure that families know that you're going to help walk them through the situation. I think that especially for these rare kids like ours, it's a lot to handle. And the amount of information that you need to tell a family in that first interaction, or even they only come twice a year, like, it has to be digestible amounts of information that will not send them reeling or spiraling when they leave of like, what did this mean? What did that mean? Digestible, mm-hmm. easy to understand information that they can take and use. Otherwise, it's not really relevant. Like, I think there were some things that were told to me that I'm like, and what do I do with that information? Like, did I need that? Does that help me with anything, or does it just make me really nervous? So yeah, I think picking the pieces of information that a family can actually use and digest.
Yeah, I'm putting this all together in my head. I'm like, so don't underestimate our kids, right? And act like they're like a robot or they can't hear you. And don't overestimate the knowledge of the parents, right? Because like that's kind of like what you're saying. Like then if they treat your child like they're not a person and then they go talk to you and like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, what does that even mean? Like, what do I do with that? Now I'm spiraling. Like you said, like it's actually doing harm. It's not helping. So I think like being like, this child is a human and this parent is also a human that probably didn't go through medical school and doesn't know what the heck I'm talking about.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So you went to Cincinnati and you got the great team on your team.
Yes.
Which is amazing and empowering. And again, like yes. That was very reaffirming to you of like your professional life too, right? Of like the importance of that. What happened between then and now? Like what has been your story?
So we got Rudy his first mobility device, which he is now able to move around our house in. It's amazing. It's called the Permobile Explorer Mini. He has a joystick. He can move. Actually, I think since Cincinnati to now has been like the most clear-minded and safe place I've been in because I'm like, I've got the diagnosis. Rudy is here. I know my future and I see Rudy's profound weakness, but Rudy has not yet been sick. I know it's coming and we've been keeping him in a bubble this winter, but we've had a bunch of good months and these months have been awesome. So we've just been able to just be like, our kid's disabled. We love him no matter what. And we do not perceive disability as a tragedy in our house. We have disability pride and it's been a good bunch of months where I'm like, I can do this. I can do this. It's going to be okay. There are days that it doesn't feel like that. And then there are days where it feels really, really okay.
I really love that for you. And I think that's like, it shows, okay, so this is something that I've been like thinking about a lot, like working with my therapist, not like Kimball's like PT, but like my therapist that's helped me. And like, we talk about a lot, like being honest with ourselves. So not being like, everything's great. I'm fine when you're not. Or being like, this is the worst. I'm never going to recover. Life sucks. It's not fair. I tend to kind of, I swing, right? So like, I've just worked really hard, like staying somewhere in between those two and being like, there can be both and statements, right? Of like, this is really hard and my life is also really great, right? So like having like both perspectives and being just really honest. And that's what it sounds like. You have found that balance of being like, the fact that we will likely lose Rudy or may someday lose Rudy is a tragedy. Like there's nothing good about that. That guts me. I hate it. It's the worst thing ever. And
Rudy's awesome.
Yeah, Rudy's awesome. His disabilities are not sad. We love him. We support him. We're figuring it out. We're coping with it. Like, I think like that's a really healthy space to be because I think if you swing too far on either side, it doesn't feel good. Either one is not overly healthy. And so I think that's really great, honest place that you're in now.
Yes, yes. And I truly feel that if you are a family who is, like you said in the beginning of this episode, there are people who, when they hear CP, are devastated. There are people, when they hear autism, are devastated. And like you said, everybody's reaction to their child's disability is completely valid. And there is no wrong way to feel. But I do feel that when you lean into the disability pride movement and start reading about how to fully embrace disability as a perfectly natural, perfectly wonderful part of life, it hurts less. And I've coached families so many times as part of an autism diagnostic team, but disability in itself is a societal challenge. Yes, our kids are not necessarily included, but we can help to lift them up and they belong here. Disabled people belong here and they are here. So I feel like for me, like I said in the beginning, like it brings me so much comfort that there are things that I can help to control, which is like lifting Rudy up and making sure that he understands that his disabled life is super valuable and awesome, just like anybody's life.
Yeah. I mean, it makes such a safe space for everyone in your family. Like it's a safe space for Rudy to feel of that like total acceptance of him. And it's a safe space for you. Like you said, it's less painful. Like I really like how you said that because I think that's true. I think once we get to that point, and if we do get to that point, you know, and I think you have complicated feelings about disability, you can be like, it'd be way easier if he could just hear me. Like, this is just inconvenient. Or I'm just like,
it would help if Rudy could lift his cup to his mouth. Like, it would help if Rudy could chew food. There's so much about disability that's inconvenient, but it's also there are so many pieces to every person, including disabled people, that are so interesting and great. Like, Rudy loves music. He loves music. He loves piano. Like, there are things that I'm just like, wow, you know what? It doesn't matter. Like, every kid has something that they love and things that they enjoy. And we can just harness that and get really deep into, like, what do you love? What brings you life? Like, what lights you up? And whenever I focus on things that light kids up, it's just like, okay, so joy is filling the room right now. Like, we're feeling really good. This is good space. Like, we like these things. Although some parts of it suck, you're still there. Like, you are a person and you have a ton of value. What do you like? What do you love?
Yeah. And I think, like, focusing on, see, what was it called? You called it the deficit.
Yeah, the deficit model versus strengths-based.
So that sounds like it definitely falls under that category of being like, but what makes them happy or what's great about this person? And I think, like, that comes easier too as, like, our kids get older and we, like, see their personalities develop more. Because I remember, like, with Kimball in the beginning, I was like, you can't see me, you can't hear me, you're in and out of the hospital all the time. There wasn't a lot of joy. There really wasn't. Like, sometimes he'd be excited to see a window because that was all he could see, and that was about it. And I was like, this just sucks. Like, his life will be horrible. And, like, that was such a dark space. But then as he got older, I could see his personality come through more and, like, his interests and his dislikes and everything. And that's when things were, like, okay. I was like, oh, right. He's a whole person, right? Like, sure, they come with these disabilities, but they also come with, like, full-on humanness too. And I think, like, as any baby, right? Like, babies, as they get older, you can see their personality more than when they're just, like, a little newborn that doesn't do anything.
Yeah. And I remember that post that you made about Kimball loving rubber gloves that, like, stuck out to me because that was one of his interests when he was little, right? He loved rubber gloves or kitchen gloves.
He did.
And I really feel like the rubber gloves are symbolic. Like, that is something that he loved. He loved the texture. He loved the way it felt. He loved the way they stretched. He liked whatever interaction he was having with those gloves. Every child, it doesn't matter. Every single person on this planet has something that they love, and we have to find it. I truly have never met a person or a child in this world. I've had so many hundreds of families that I've done therapy with, and there's not one that didn't have something they loved or something that brought joy out in them. I just feel like it's on us to kind of find it. But when we're clouded by, like, stigmatized ideas of what disability is, it's really hard to see it because it looks like there's a rain cloud. My husband and I have talked about, like, this raven. I just feel like this is, like, a good imagery that I've been using, that there's this raven that's following us around, and that's, like, Rudy's disease. And it kind of just feels like even when we have moments of joy, like, it's kind of, like, hovering, like, it's on the church pew behind us as we're at the park. Like, when we're playing outside, like, it might fly above us. Like, it's always part of us, but, like, now it's, like, kind of, like, an integrated part of our family, the raven. Like, it's here, it's dark, it doesn't always feel good, and sometimes it's, like, way too close, and we're like, okay, this part's kind of painful. But also sometimes it's in the distance and it's just looming down on us, and we can still have joy and have the raven with us. Like, he can be part of it. We know he's here. We're not pretending he's not. But I don't know if this makes sense. This is kind of
makes total sense. So I'm like, yes, yes, yes. That's my internal dialogue as you're saying this.
So I just have this imagery of this raven, and I'm like, okay, I kind of want to do, like, a children's book with the raven and, like, how to, like, integrate him, how to love him, how to, like, accept the dark side as, like, it's just mixed in.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's so true. I keep thinking back about, like, as we're talking about, like, disability and, like, the whole positive outlook on disability, right, and, like, the acceptance. Like, I think that if there's a parent listening right now who's like, oh, crap, I don't feel that way. Like, I really don't. I just kind of hate that he can't walk, or I just wish that she could hear me without whatever. Like, any of these things, there's, like, a learning period. And I think that, like, because you had that background professionally, like, you had done the work, right? Like, you read the books, you did the research. And I think the more you do that, the more it's easier to see. Like, it really is. I think, like, seeing these disabled adults, just disabled people, like, talk about, like, oh yeah, like, you know, a wheelchair is a great tool and I love my wheelchair, da, 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 like, things like that. Like, you're kind of like, wow, that's such an interesting perspective I never thought about before. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, the more we learn, and it might take a long time, like, I think, like, allowing yourself space to both do the education and, like, to learn and to research while also holding space for, you know, even if the raven isn't them passing away, even if the raven is I'm so sad you'll never walk, right? Like, I think having like this acceptance of this thing.
I am so sad about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is something I've said this a lot. And I feel like if any of my families are listening to this, they're like, oh my gosh, she said this to me. This is truly how I feel. And actually, this is just factually true. Your child is genetically who they are, like the pieces that I love about Rudy. Rudy is not Rudy plus like a bag that he's carrying and this is Llama 2. And he's like, I'd be perfect if only I could just drop this piece. Like, this is genetically part of Rudy. He does not exist without it. They are integrated. They are one. Like, this is him. There is no Rudy without this part. Because this is the stardust mix that he is. So same with like autism. Like, we don't carry our autism. And if it was just gone, we'd be different. Like, it is integrated into your person. That's why this whole like identity purse, like, you're not a person with autism. You're an autistic person, because there is no shame in it. It is part of you and it's okay. But I do feel like what you were just saying of like doing that work, I think it's worth doing. I really do. I feel like it's not just worth it for you and your own ability to feel at peace with your child's diagnosis, but it's also for your child.
Yeah.
Because we teach them how they view themselves, and the way that we view disability becomes like self-hatred, it could be, or, you know, internalized ableism. And we want to not do that. Like, we want them to feel good about who they are and feel like their disability does not diminish any part of them. Although, like we said, it is inconvenient. There are pieces that are just like, God, if I could just walk, I could get into this ice cream store that doesn't have a ramp. Like, if I could just walk, I wouldn't need my mom to carry me from room to room, or et cetera. All of the types of disabilities. I mean, it could go on and on.
I like to think of it like, how do I want Kimball to think of his disability? And I know, like, maybe this won't feel quite as applicable to people if they're like, my child, they're not at the level where they can really understand these concepts, but still. Just from my point of view, like with Kimball, I'm like, how do I want him to view his disabilities? And I want him to have the full range. I want him to have permission to be really annoyed one day. Like, I hate being so short. Like, it's just so annoying. I want to be tall like my friends, which he's dealing with that right now. But also to be like, and I'm awesome the way I am. Like, I'm so cool. I love every bit of me, even if I get annoyed. And so I think, like, we are modeling that. And it's a little different because, you know, most of the audience, they're born this way and they don't know any different. They never expected anything different. So it is different. But I do think that, like, we are modeling. And I think, like, thinking of it that way, like, how do I want either my disabled child to view themselves, or also, like, if their sibling's in the picture, like, how do I want their sibling to view disability and their sibling? Like, I want them to be, again, honest, to be really honest about it, to be like, I wish that he could walk. That'd be really cool. And I feel sad sometimes, but also I love this about him and I love his wheelchair and we're figuring it out. And this is, like you said, is part of who he is. I think, I don't know, thinking of it that way has been helpful to me.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's the same for any, like, even an able-bodied kid. Like, I want you to have the full range. Like, none of us are living like, I love every part of myself. Everything about me is awesome. Like, of course there is a range. Like, I want Rudy to have that range too, but I also don't want him to have so much feelings that are negative about his disability that are completely based on the fact that he does not view disability as a valid and natural human experience. Like, I just feel that there are pieces of self-love that we can really, as parents and as professionals who are like me before I had kids, like working with families and trying to harness the areas that are beautiful and strong within our kids helps them view themselves as those things.
Yeah. And it really does like bleed over into all areas of life. Like you say, this isn't limited to disabled people. Like, this is everyone. And like, we've had conversations with my older daughter who is totally healthy. There were no like medical issues, anything. And like, subsequently, we've been like, I've done research. I'm like, you know, I bet you're autistic. I really bet you are. We don't have an official diagnosis or anything. And she's like, I don't know if you're allowed to say this. She's highly functioning. Like, she would never get an IEP or anything. Like, this is like a pretty subtle thing.
Right.
But it's been really cool to talk to her about it and be like,
she's a classic underlooked girl with autism who, doesn't get the IEP, you know, the classic what happens to us girls.
Yeah, I'm like, you're pretty good at masking, huh? Like, I can see this. Yeah. And so like, I've talked to her about it and be like, hey, I think you might be autistic. She's like, oh, cool. Tell me about that. I'm like, okay. So like, you notice how like this and this happens? She's like, oh yeah. Like, you know how you like have issues with like sensory, you don't really like to wear that. She's like, oh, that's totally true. But like, as we were talking about it, I was able to like there are things about you, like sure, like her not wanting to wear pants is inconvenient when it's snowy outside. Like, right, there's like things like that. But there's also like all these things. I'm like, I love all these things about Wendy. Like, they're what makes her herself. And so I think like the fact that we've talked about disability so much, like with context of Kimball and like the children's books that we have and stuff, she was like, great, that's awesome, I'm autistic. And then she just skipped off and she was like fine with it. And so I think like
that's like the perfect example where it's like, now she has something that makes sense. Like, it makes sense. Yeah. And it helps you have an identity that can explain and validate your experience. Like, to pretend like Rudy's disability isn't real or like it doesn't change anything. Like, you are disabled, dude. Like, you are not gonna walk. You are not gonna crawl. You need help with stuff and it's okay. Like, that is who you are and it makes sense. I want him to know all about Llama 2. Like, this is what's happening to your muscles. This is why you don't walk. This is why your friends do walk. Blah, blah, blah. You know, it goes on and on. But like what you did for your daughter, that's huge. Like, having an identity that's positive and explains your life experience can only do good.
And again, it goes back to the work, right? And I think like if there are parents listening, they're like, I'm so early on, I'm drowning in all this, like, you know, put it on a shelf. Like, I'm not saying like, oh, read all these things. And I'm not trying to shame anyone, but like doing the work, I mean, like,
hell no.
I've followed a lot of like autistic adults on Instagram. And so I'm like, I've read the stuff. They've really embraced their autism and they like are really proud about it. And I'm like, so that laid the foundation for me. I have a whole different attitude about it than I did before. And then that's, again, that's translating onto Kimball. That's translating to Wendy. And like, it's just amazing the repercussions it can have and how much it impacts our quality of life, right? Like, our family is happier that way. Like you said, it makes it less painful.
It makes it less painful.
So it is worth the work.
It really is. And I would say, like, if you're drowning right now, this part is easy. Remember this, like, your child is exactly who they are. Like, the parts that you love, I feel like the separation of like, I wish they just like, but this is them. Like, look at who is in front of you. Like, we love them. Like, this does suck. Yes. But like, also, they're here and they're really great. And I don't know, I just feel like it really helps me to understand, like, it is integrated into who they are, and to love them and wish for one part of them to go would be to wish for all of them to go. Like, I want Rudy to have a cure, but at the same time, like, Rudy does not exist without Llama 2, and I love Rudy, and Rudy is awesome, and it is integral into who he is. So I'm hoping that there's something that will help, but at the same time, this is him, and I would do absolutely nothing different. I want him forever to be him.
I love that so much. Okay, this was like such a great conversation. I feel like we could talk for like hours.
Well, we can just keep talking off of this one day. You know, now we're friends and we can like chat anytime.
There you go. It'll be an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, and I just listened to that episode the other day about finding people, like when you hang up and you're like, I could actually be friends with them. Be friends with me.
Yay, a new friend. We just made friends.
Yeah,
I'm like,
let's
I don't know
friends.
How to tell people how to make friends because like, well, I'm interviewing people all the time. That's how I find my friends. So that's not a very accessible, generalized advice.
You know,
but yeah, I love making friends.
Everyone fend for yourself, you know? You found your way.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for all of your insight and wisdom. I really appreciate it. I am so confident that this conversation has helped a lot of people. So thank you.
I'm so hopeful that it did.
You can find links to the books mentioned in this episode in the show notes. You can also find ways to connect with Serena and with me in the show notes. Also in there are a couple episodes that might interest you after listening to this one. One of them is a solo episode called To Those Who Cannot Say I Wouldn't Have Them Any Other Way. A huge thank you to Serena for sharing so openly about her experience. And to Alyssa, my incredible team member who assists in all things post-production, which is a lifesaver. And to everyone who has supported the podcast monetarily and made donations. You make it all possible. Join us next week for an episode all about sharing the mental and physical load of caring for our disabled children with our child's other parent, with therapist and disability parents Amanda Griffith-Atkins and her husband. It is one I think we all need. Don't miss it. See you then.